coming to you from Orange County, California. This is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, what is up? Chad Wesley Smith here, another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. My guest today, Mr. Les Spellman. Les, how you doing, bud?
Good, how are you?
Good. Very good, very good. So Les is a speed coach, performance coach, Spellman Performance. All right. And consulting for all kind of different places, USA Rugby, Mamba Sports Academy, getting guys ready for the combine, getting people ready to run fast. So you know, if you watched our episode several weeks ago with Jay Agabow when we visited Mamba Sports Academy as they were doing combine prep, you probably saw Les coaching those guys up. So we want to talk to him about his athletic background, kind of what's brought him to this point as a coach, and ways that you all can get faster, can get your athletes faster. So yeah, let's just hop right into it.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, we've only met briefly, so yeah, this is as much for me to get to know you as all of them. But tell me a little bit about your athletic background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, first, like, this whole experience is crazy. For all those listening, like, I grew up reading every single book you wrote, every single one. And, like, the biggest thing for me was, like, the simplicity of it. So, like, coming up as a strength coach and speed coach, I didn't really understand, like, periodization when I first started. So reading your books, like, I was able to understand, like, when to periodize, like, how to put things first, like, how to organize your week. I'd read Charlie Francis, so, like, I was looking into, like, how to organize a week through the nervous system. And, yeah, it was pretty cool just, like, understanding that. And it gave me so much more knowledge than all these, like, super scientific books because I couldn't relate to it.
Well, that's the real reason I brought you on was just to stroke my own ego.
So, yeah, there's that. But my story is pretty unique. Like, I grew up and I wasn't that great of an athlete. And it's funny when I tell people that, I tell my kids that I train and they're like, "No, you were always good." I'm like, "No, dude, I was actually awful. I was super inflexible, weak. I was like 5'5" in high school. And I wasn't very fast either. So, you know, long story short, like, I realized, like, college sports weren't going to be my thing. And so I thought.
And you grew up in San Diego?
In D.C. In D.C., yep. So 2007, my senior year, I ended up getting in a really bad car accident and break my femur. And the next day, like, after surgery, doctors came in and they're like, "Les, like, you might be able to walk again. You're going to have a limp, but you'll never run. It's not even possible for you to run." And I was, like, one of the first people to have this, like, type of surgery on my femur. And they put the, you know, the metal rod in and the screw at the top and screw at the bottom and screwed it together. And I just looked at the x-rays, like, "Man, I really want to run again." Like, I became obsessed. And I was never a good runner. So for me, it was, like, out of this world. And I remember this one story. My mom was sitting by the bed, and I was like, "Hey, Mom, like, I'm going to go to the Olympics." And she thought I was, like, high on morphine. anyway, long story short, So I took the time and I started reading. I started learning how to walk. And by walking, I started to figure out, like, how my feet contact the ground, like, where my hips are, how my core stabilizes with each step, like, how important, like, lateral stabilizers are. And I was like, okay, maybe this is the same principles for running. And started running just, like, real slow. It took me 18 months to get to that point. And I was running, like, I think the first time I ran was, like, 90 minutes, and I went a couple miles. So it wasn't a lot. And every day I just started getting out there and running and figuring it out. And as I started getting faster in my running, I started to realize the patterns were the same. It was about stacking my hips, keeping my core tight, you know, keeping my pelvis neutral, started to understand pelvic control before I even read anything about, like, biomechanics. And, you know, I had this crazy idea. Came home one day and I was like, "You know what? Like, I want to run track." And I told my mom, she's like, "I don't know. Like, we should go back to the doctor." So we go back to the doctor and doctor's like, "Look, you've broken both screws in your legs. And, it's not going to feel well if you run. You could try it, but it's not going to feel well." Of course I ignored him and, ended up walking on to a Division I track team. And I ran track for 3 years in college. And then after college, I was like, "All right, I thought I was gonna get way faster." You know, like, I had been lifting, I've been running, I've been doing all the drills, I've been stretching. I'm like, okay, cool. Like, I've done all the parachute workouts, the stadium workouts. You guys, I don't know if you guys are young or not, but we used to wear ankle weights. And like, we'd run with ankle weights.
I was on the jump soles myself.
Yeah, jump soles. So I got these big calves. I tried everything.
You do have some fucking huge calves.
I do. It's probably the jump soles. If they still sell them, man, those are calf builders.
Those things are crazy, though, because you know, I did those, I think, going into my senior year of high school and then going into my freshman year of college.
Yeah.
And I was big. I was, in that whole time between 250 and 275.
Right.
And thinking about what those workouts were like, you know, they're like 500 contact, high
for
intensity
real.
Plyometrics.
Yeah.
Maybe I can make it one day.
Yeah.
One day through one of those workouts now before every Achilles is
seriously
just fucking destroyed.
Seriously, man. Like, and I thought that was the Holy Grail. And,
oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I got out of college and realized, like, I tried that. So what was I doing wrong? And that's where I really started, like, my study of biomechanics and understanding the body and starting to figure out, like, how alignment plays a certain tool and how strength plays a certain tool and how everything I was doing was right, but maybe it wasn't organized correctly or maybe it wasn't progressed correctly or maybe it wasn't detailed enough to get me to the goal. And I started just, I read everything, every article I could find, every, every study I could find. And, you know, I'm still in that process. So this is like super humbling for me because I feel like I'm still on the way up and like understanding. And I've been lucky to have success. And, you know, I attributed that to like more communication and trying to figure out and figuring it out as I go. And realizing like 90% of the time I don't even have the full answer, but I'm going to figure it out. And through figuring it out, I figure it out for another athlete. And each athlete that comes, I'm like, all right, cool. Like, I think I remember from the last guy how to do this one. And, so that's kind of how it started.
So in the process of learning about training, you're what, 29?
29.
Yep. In the process of learning about training, I feel like a lot of people, I turned 33 in about 2 months, so I don't want to be like old man on the porch shaking my fist here, but I feel like kids these days, it's so much easier to get information now about training even than it was 5 years ago or,
right.
you know, 8, 10 years ago.
Right.
And when you were, beginning this process and finding articles and doing all that stuff, you're also seeking coaches out.
Right, exactly.
You know, you were making phone calls, terrifying. I know kids.
terrifying
to make a phone call to someone to hear their voice on the other line and go in places to learn from coaches. Mm. So, what are some of the experiences you had there?
Oh my God! Well, number one was Tony Villani in Florida. And this is 2008. And I walked into his gym and I saw him training like all the NFL guys that I watched on TV. And this is my first view of combine training. I'm like, What is that? Like, it's not football, but it's not speed, it's not track. And that was like my first introduction to like what combine training looked like. And I remember from that point, I just talked to Tony like 2 weeks ago, and I was like, dude, I remember that first day I walked in your gym. He didn't even remember me. And it was just unreal. So Tony was amazing. He opened his doors, taught me a lot. Then Elias Karras in Chicago. And I learned so much through him. He basically gave me my start, and I approached him. I said, hey, can I clean your gym? And in return, just to learn from you and the other guys. So that's what I did. I was basically a janitor. That was my first job in training, was folding towels, protein shakes, mopping, dusting stuff, like painting. That was my first job, and I kept a little notebook. And through Elias, I started meeting more people. He taught me about Charlie Francis. Obviously, Charlie passed, so I wasn't able to talk to him, but reading everything that he did. And then I went down the pedigree, and I was like, okay, like, who came after Charlie?
Mm.
Okay, Dan Pfaff and Jonas and you, of course. Like, I started figuring out the pedigree and how things started to play out and who was current and what I could learn from the past guys. And probably, like I said, the biggest guy is Elias. Elias, like, taught me everything. From the jump without asking me for anything. Like, he never was like, oh, pay me for my time or do any of that. It was all like just love. He just taught me everything. And then more recently, Jonas Dodu in England. And Jonas is, if you guys don't know, one of the best sprint coaches in the world. He has a couple of 9-9 sprinters, some top jumpers, he's got some medalists. And I reached out to him probably in 2015. And I was like, hey, I'm a young black guy coming up. I feel like I don't know exactly what I'm doing, but I have USA Rugby and we're going to the Olympics. And he hit me right back. He's like, what do you need help with? And we basically figured out like how to structure, how much volume to put in things. I was struggling in the beginning with volume because I didn't want to do too much volume. I didn't want to do too little. So I got my coaching model really from Jonas and Dan Paff and those guys and you. So, yeah.
So you mentioned USA Rugby and going to the Olympics. How did that connection come about?
Yeah, I was lucky. I was like a very average rugby player coming out. Coming out of college, I tried rugby. I was like extremely average.
You're playing sevens or
playing
15s?
Playing sevens. And I'd happened to go to like a couple all-star camps. And you know, at the time, like I feel like not too many people were playing. So if you had some athleticism, you're gonna find your way into like, you know, some all-star teams or anything like that. And I went to the Olympic Training Center and I saw it and I was like, man, I wanna be there. And started working my butt off and, you know, trying to get there. And in the process, I met some coaches that ended up, you know, being on the national team as staff. And they remembered me as a player and they remember that I was coaching on the side. And I started working with some players that were left over. You know, going to tournaments, they would take 12 guys and leave six or seven back at home. Mm-hmm. And I would take those six or seven guys and I would work with them. And those guys would come back to the next camp a little bit faster. And coaches were like, okay, what's going on? Like, how are you guys getting faster? And I was lucky to have some guys that like mentioned my name. And they brought me in for a workout one time to like train the whole team. And I remember that day, like I came down there with a truck full of stuff and set up all the equipment, made the field look nice, like listened to music, ran a lap, and like I was super nervous. And because they were filming it. And that's how I got the job. So it started out like unpaid, like, you know, I was just there. I was basically like a glorified intern that also taught speed. You know, like I would go like fill water bottles up and do other basic stuff, and then I would coach my speed part. And I was lucky to have 3 days, and which it was just insane. Like I got to test out all my crazy theories and make mistakes, and you know, had enough time to recover, which is huge because I feel like if you feel like you're in a pressurized situation, you can't make a mistake, then you can't grow. And I was very, very, very lucky to have like an early learning experience at 24. 25 years old, how to, you know, coach an Olympic level program. So,
what's one mistake maybe that you made that really stands out in your mind, thinking like, Les, you were so stupid then.
Yeah, I would just say like a overemphasis on things looking right. You know, like I just became obsessed with the detail of like everything looking perfect. And what I started to see was like sometimes guys would look perfect and run slow. I was like, oh, wait a minute. Like, what is this? Like, you look good. You did everything I told you. I'm not coaching to the right model. And I have to get out of my own way and stop thinking, like, I'm such a good coach by how things look and look more at, like, what are we producing? What kind of, you know, how are we increasing horizontal velocity? And if it doesn't answer that question, then it's a throwaway.
And so, you think some of that goes to the idea of, like, trying to coach everyone to the same model, because this is something I see a lot in my, you know, background in the shot put discus, that there are some coaches who they try and make all their throwers throw the same way.
Yeah.
And some of them might throw really far that way, and some of them might not. And other people kind of, you know, they coach instead of coaching the athlete to the system, they change the system for the athlete.
Yeah, it's a mix. Like, I think like if you have a philosophy, for example, like we have a philosophy on alignment. And there's an ideal alignment you would want to have, but there's intricacies between like athletes. Like each athlete's different, so they might have a different femur length and different tibia length, or you know, their hips sit different. So the way that they process the information that I tell them might be a completely different way. And you know, if we're working towards that standard for a year and they're just not getting it, it's not them. It's like that's their cap there, and we got to move on. And it's about energy expenditure. Like, I don't want to spend, you know, 4 hours trying to get your feet to go more neutral. Like, if you're built like that, then you might be built like that. So I think the model is flexible, but there's definitely things within that model that are non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. Like, we're always going to work towards it. My boy Quincy always said, you can't go broke making a profit. So if you're working towards that thing, you can't be wrong. But if you're working away from it, obviously, then it's wrong. Yeah.
So as we look at some of the work you've done, rugby, combine prep, football stuff, big, fairly significant differences there in like the energetic demands.
Yep.
You get these sevens rugby guys who got a, they got to have a big gas tank in there, and then you got combine prep guys and track stuff, and combine is just a glorified track meet, I guess. So as you look at balancing speed development and conditioning, the big word that is conditioning. You see that line getting blurred by coaches, or what is speed development? What is the distinction that coaches need to understand?
Yeah, well, I mean, in rugby, there's no finish line. There's no like stopwatch on the field. It's like, oh, you're this fast. The measuring stick is really, can you beat a defender?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot different. But when I came into rugby, I think coaches thought I was like kind of like how other speed coaches were, where they looked at speed as a conditioning type thing, where they just ran through drills over and over and over again to get stronger. And the best way to get faster is a bunch of reps. And like, you will, especially in the high school market. But with these guys, it's like they're already doing 10,000 meters, running that week or more, like sometimes 30,000 meters in a week. So the more volume I put on them, the more injury risk they have, and the more likely I am to lose my job. So I had to kind of adapt my model to that, which is kind of the best thing, because when I looked at speed, I stopped thinking about speed as like how we look at strength. Like in strength, it makes sense. Like there's a linear progression you take, to getting stronger. In speed, it's more of it's like ballet, or it's like martial arts. Like you have to reach certain levels of alignment to progress to the next level. And in martial arts, you walk in there, they don't slap you a black belt and they're like, all right, go fight that guy. They're like, no, go stand in the mirror and practice this stance. And when you get that stance, you move to the next stance. And when I started thinking about speed in that way, it kind of was fluid for any sport. So if I looked at rugby, I'm going to teach you the model, and then I'm going to look at your sport and figure out how that model can apply to your sport. And then I look at, combine, and I'm like, how can I take my model and put it in combine? Now, and all that really changes is how you apply it. So whether your application is your 40-yard dash, or your application is like you being in a game and hitting 11 meters per second, that's your standard. They're different ideas, but they're the same kind of way to get there. And then we branch out after that.
If you guys haven't heard about Roan, you're really missing out. Roan is a men's performance lifestyle and premium activewear brand that's engineered for unparalleled quality and comfort. They're an absolute necessity for guys on the go. Doesn't matter if you're training, in the gym, jumping on international flights, they're a new go-to men's clothing brand. My favorites are the Swift Tanks. Love to train in those. Also the Sequoia Quarter Zip. I can wear that out to dinner. I can wear it to the gym. They make something for everyone, for the modern man, regardless of occasion. And they just released their new commuter collection. I've got a couple of their commuter polos, the commuter tech polo, really nice material. As a bigger man, I tend to sweat on occasion, and it's got like a nice moisture wicking going on there. Their commuter collection is a performance alternative to everyday workwear, offering everything from pants, polos, shorts, and shirts to the lightweight, comfortable, wrinkle-free. Commuter collection is good for all weather, anytime from a weekday in the workplace or a weekend barbecue. So go check out roan.com/juglife today and use promo code juglife to get 20% off your first purchase. That's Roan, roane.com/juglife. Use juglife for 20% off, roane.com/juglife. Use the promo code JUGLIFE, 20% off. So this year at the Combine, you had a lot of guys do great, most notably Quinnen Williams,
mm-hmm.
At 4.83 at 303 pounds,
right? Yeah.
Big man moving. Greedy Williams ran under 4.4. You had how many guys that you worked with this year run in the 4.3s?
We had 5 4.3s. We had 10 guys sub 4.5.
And so as you're looking at developing that 40-yard dash speed technique, the whole package, if you had it your way, and I know there's maybe a lot of cooks in the kitchen sometimes when you're dealing with position coaches and everything, but how would you be setting the week up for speed development when you have control of everything?
That's I think the organization of the week is probably the most important thing. if I'm a terrible coach and I just organize things in the right ways, and that's what I learned from you, then I'm going to have some success. So I just go off principles. So for speed, what I look at, if I had like 100% control, I'm going to look at acceleration first. I'm going to look at, to me, that's the most important component. And then also nervous system wise, it's the longest, like you have the longest pushes, you have the longest nervous system activation in that. In,
would you draw any distinction there of acceleration being the most important for a team sport athlete or a field sport athlete compared to a track athlete?
Yeah, I think in everything it's about it's acceleration first. For me, you know, and there's probably like other philosophies, so I'm not saying that's gospel, but in order to attain max velocity, that's kind of dependent on how well you accelerate. And especially in a team sport, when you're looking at, you know, most athletes are sub-maximal, meaning like they're not hitting their max speeds their body's capable of in a game. It's about how you attain that max velocity. So I say like you get 80, I mean, a goal would be to get to 80% of your max velocity in 10 steps or, you know, 40% in 3 steps. So like we kind of have KPIs based around that. But yeah, I would say really like the team sport is acceleration. Both are acceleration. Yeah.
So we're going to prioritize acceleration in the week. That's going to be our Monday workout.
Yeah, Monday. Yep. And then I'll pair that with like a max strength. And this is probably my like obsession with studying Charlie Francis in the beginning. And I'm sure you could poke holes in it. But to me, it's logical. Like long ground contact times and acceleration and long pushes and max strength. Like to me, they're the same nervous system demand. And I want to put those two things together. Now, some people would argue it's too much loading, it's too much volume, but if you saw our speed work, it's like it's light in comparison to what you would expect. So
I think for people who especially haven't been around elite sprinters, Olympic level sprinters, once you get around that, and I remember the first time I was telling you with these warm weather training camps with UK Athletics, to see Dwayne Chambers, and it was Dwayne Chambers, Simeon Williamson, Mark Findlay, a bunch of guys running down in the low tens, high nines, and you see them do their acceleration or their max speed training, and it's like, all right, this guy just ran 50 meters, and then he sat around for 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like these guys are lazy as shit.
Exactly.
You know? And but when you can really go, when you can really run, it's such a huge output every time,
such a huge,
neural input to the athlete. They can't do a lot.
Right. Exactly. You know, and that's like, I don't know, like people are like, oh, football is different. But to me, it's the same. Your nervous system is the same. And the demand on it is the same. So 100%. Yep.
Yeah. And I guess where the distinction would start to be created from as you look at one sport compared to the other is the lengths that they're running. And then probably more so in the aerobic work they're doing.
Yep.
And so we're working acceleration, max strength on Monday. It's going to be a tempo session on Tuesday.
Yep. So, like, Tuesday, like, if I'm doing combine, I'm looking at Tuesday, like, I always have my tempo in mind. But what I do is I do, like, a tempo warm-up. So the warm-up is a little bit longer. You know, they're jogging out a little bit longer, backpedaling. I like to add in, like, different, very shuffles, karaoke's, backward hip openers. And then I do hurdles. Like, I love the track hurdles on Tuesdays Tuesdays and Fridays. And what we'll do is we'll do the hurdles and then we'll jog out. So that's like my tempo based. And then we'll do some med ball work.
So when you say do the hurdles, like walkovers?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. So like we'll do walkovers, over unders. We do like an A series over, sideways, a straight leg, straight bent, bent straight, 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 single bent, single straight, and then we face forward and we do like hurdle leg overs. Mm-hmm. We probably have like a 15-20 minute hurdle warm up.
The side of my ass is burning just thinking about it.
For real. Yeah.
Yeah, we do a lot of that kind of hurdle walkover stuff in the fall period for when I was throwing the shot put and the piriformis, my hip flexors are getting going just thinking about it.
You get strong though.
Yeah.
So you get them strong.
And then so, 40 yard dash and most of the athletes, they're not really getting out to a distance where true max velocity work is going to be applicable. So you're reserving that more for just track and field?
Well, we definitely have like a max velocity day, but it's like for combine, it's like a blend. So like we don't take away the start, because if you look at like sprinters and how they train, they will actually like take out the start and they'll work on just top speed, mm-hmm. top speed, and do all that. And, you know, they're so mechanically efficient.
And they'd be doing that as like a flying 30 or
yeah
in and out kind of stuff.
Exactly, in and outs. And, you know, like for us, like number one, there's an injury risk. You know, guys, you're not going to teach them how to run incredibly well in a couple weeks. So you got to kind of err on the safe side. So we do 5.10s, we do 5.20s, but I kind of mix the two skills. So I blend acceleration with like a max velocity stimulus. So whether that's like an overspeed dribble, have you seen dribbles?
I'm not familiar.
So a dribble is basically like a progressive step over. And if you think about it, like simply put, like you step over with 25% power into the ground and you'll come about ankle height. And you're moving forward and then you go 50% and then your shin height, and then you go 75% and your knee height, 100% and now you're running. So it's like a progressive way to teach like a cyclical step over pattern.
Okay.
And so we'll do that with like an overspeed pull, but I don't believe in like running them overspeed. But we'll just do the drill where they're getting pulled a little bit faster. So they're getting pulled instead of 3 meters per second, they're moving 5 meters per second or seven, something like that.
So for the folks watching at home, if they're not familiar with the term overspeed, explain that, and then explain why you're
reserved.
Having aversion to that.
Yeah. So the overspeed is when you put a belt on and you have a bungee or a pulley and someone pulls you faster. So like let's say you run naturally 10 meters per second, they're going to pull you 12. What I've seen, and I've seen it done successfully a lot of times, but a lot of times I've seen it unsuccessfully because you're getting pulled faster. So the number one thing that happens is your body creates a natural braking force. And they slam the foot in front of the other foot, and it hits the heel, and they break for a second. And then their body crosses over, and they go to their next step. And that's, like, my biggest pet peeve with it is, like, you contact too far away from the body. When you do an overspeed dribble, it's controlled.
When you're talking about too far from the body, that their lead leg is landing out in front of their base of support too much.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's going to be where pulled hamstrings tend to happen.
Right, exactly. But with the dribble, it's controlled because the whole goal of the drill is to step under the hip. So you just get pulled a little bit faster, but not too fast under the hip.
And then you mentioned the times you've seen it work successfully. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm guessing you're seeing that work with very high-level track sprinters because they have the most stable technique.
Exactly.
Yeah, you get a sophomore in high school, linebacker, and he's been going to his speed and agility quickness coach for the last 2 months, and like, all right, let's hook this kid up to a harness, and he's got all kind of fucked up technique to begin with,
then
you just fuck it up more.
Exactly.
With that, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and that's a scary thing, and that's with a guy. In combine, like you're a good coach if they get through the combine healthy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I don't care what anyone says. Like, if you can get them healthy to the end, you're good. So I don't like to take a lot of risk with that. Yeah.
So, of course, we got a lot of meathead powerlifters and weightlifters watching this. So they want to know about the weight room.
Yeah.
So how does maximal strength, the real transfer to speed?
Yeah.
Like how do you see that relationship?
Yeah, I mean that's. Speed to me is force. It's force into the ground. And the stronger an athlete is per percentage body weight, so mass specific force, like you hear a lot of people talk about that. And it's really like, to me, I explain it to kids, like if you weigh 100 pounds and you can move 200, then you got decent strength to run fast. Like you got decent strength. So I know a lot of people have played around with numbers and they found a magic 3.75 number, 3.5. Like to me, like we just work towards the standard. So we want to get you stronger, but I'm not looking to like make a massive, jump in your max strength because I don't have enough time to unload you and keep you healthy. So for max strength, we usually do trap bar deadlifts. There's a less variance in technique, So like if I have athletes squat and they went to 50 different schools, they're gonna have 50 different techniques and coaching points, and I don't want to go in there and psychologically mess the kid up because, I'm not a strength coach first. Like that's not what I went into it. And I was like, I want to be a strength coach. So I kind of look at specialists to kind of figure that out. So trap bar deadlift for me has been the easiest transfer for max strength.
I think you find a lot of times too with, especially as you get the high level athletes, guys who have a really good body, who are going to play in the NFL, who have that kind of body type, long legs, short torso relative, like is a bad body to squat.
Yeah.
So I think that's where people get kind of confused and start to conflate these ideas of a really high correlation between squatting strength and sprinting speed. Yep. Is the person who's built to squat really well is not built to run really fast.
Yeah.
And trying to, you know, kind of put this square peg into a round hole of the person who's got this great body to sprint and can get a ton of stimulus from sprinting and jumping, but trying to now I'm going to make you a weightlifter, I'm going to make you a powerlifter. This is a tough road that I see too many coaches go down, because it's a very simple thing to chase that number.
Right.
And if you got to report that to, you know, parents or head coach or whoever it is, and tell them, well, you know, Jimmy used to squat this much and now he does this much. So like, it's very easy for them to understand an improvement there. But like the point of diminishing returns on that stuff is much lower than a lot of strength coaches would like to think that it is.
Yeah, no, 100%. And then, you know, just hearing that perspective kind of makes me feel better, because like the way you put it just makes sense. And that's kind of like our philosophy on it. So we would do like speed squats or band squats, you know, things like that on our max velocity days. And reason being, like, we're moving the bar fast with velocity. That's what we're doing on the track or on the field. So it pairs well. Mm. And that's when we would squat. So we're doing pin squats. We might do toe box squat. We might do reverse band squats. You know, that's kind of like our way to move the bar fast.
Yeah, and some people are probably listening to this and they're like, listen, you hear that, Chad? He just said a bunch of fucking West Side stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you
know,
he's showing you.
Yeah.
And I actually agree, because I do think that type of stuff is very useful in strength and conditioning settings, because it's moving heavy shit fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when, especially if you stay away from true max effort work, because one, it's just not necessary for someone who's not an elite lifter to do max effort. You know, I'm going to go to one rep max or three rep max every week to get stronger. They don't need to do that. And it would, you know, to go back to both of our affinities for Charlie Francis, like, if your nervous system is a cup, why would I fill my cup up with something that's so general?
Right.
Yeah. Why would I fill it up so much with really heavy, you know, max effort box squat or something? But the squatting with bands, speed squat kind of stuff, like, it's definitely got a lot of application there.
Yeah. Especially for combine, you need to give them different stimuluses fast. It's like, you got to roll, so.
Yeah. So you work with a lot of youth athletes as well, and that's probably, you know, what most of our listeners have more opportunity to work with.
Right.
Youth athletes, high school athletes, not everyone's getting to train the number three pick in the NFL draft. So if you were to pick one big mistake you see people making with youth athletes that you could help them correct, what would that be?
You know, a lot of athletes, or a lot of coaches, I should say, kind of approach training youth athletes like they're in a team setting, like how they would if they were their high school coach, where they're putting on volume and, you know, they're directing them and they're yelling at them. And, you know, it's really like a dominant relationship. But in the private industry, what I've seen also is like you're actually not in the dominant relationship. Like, you have athletes that are coming to you and they're coming to you for a reason. So you need to figure out what value they're trying to get from you and then provide that.
That was always a tricky dynamic there, because I coached high school football and track for 3 years before I started Juggernaut.
Yep.
And, well, those guys got to do whatever the fuck I say because I'm the coach.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then you flip it and it's like, all right, now they're your clients, but they're the ones who pay you, so they're your boss now, kind of.
Yeah.
And it is a tricky balance to strike sometimes.
Yeah, 100%. So, like, when I look at speed for them, I'm trying to figure out biomechanically, like, where can I provide value? So when you go back to more volume in your school setting, which you need, you definitely need volume, are you going to be more biomechanically efficient to handle that volume and then become a better athlete as a result of it? And that's my entire job. So I don't look at it like, all right, I'm just going to get your 40 time down. Like, that's a byproduct of everything else we're doing. Like, for me, can you strike closer to center of mass? Can you accelerate? Can you master these technical skills? If you can do those things, you can't go broke making a profit. So you're not going to get slower.
Mm.
So that's kind of how
So if someone's working in the private setting and they have, you know, limited time, maybe they see a high school athlete twice a week, and then the high school strength coach sees them, you know, three or four other times. Mm-hmm. You want that private person to the private facility person to put as much quality with them, attention to detail to the technique. Don't over-volumize them, because you know that's probably going to happen when they're back at the school. Like, I used to train a lot of volleyball players, and of course every volleyball player, I want to jump higher, I want to jump higher. Every parent, she needs to jump higher, she needs to jump higher. Mm-hmm. Like, well, you just came from volleyball practice where you jumped like 200 fucking times.
Yep.
So how is jumping 50 more times gonna make this a better thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got to kind of fill in the holes around that.
Exactly. And you just find out like where are they weak. Like maybe we need to work more glute med. And then you ask, oh, why am I on the side of the ground lifting my leg up? Well, mm-hmm. how is that going to make me faster? And you got to kind of, you have to be a good communicator and figure out how do I communicate the importance of this really basic, boring exercise into your sprinting speed and answer the question why we haven't run yet. And it's 10 minutes into the workout, you know, like, so that's kind of been always the conundrum.
Well, and like we talked about too before we started recording, it's a very similar idea for effective powerlifting and weightlifting training. Like, the best training, it ain't that sexy. It ain't that interesting.
Yeah.
It's not changing all the time. You know, you're talking about these guys come in and they say, oh, I want to do this drill, I want to do that drill. And as you're, you know, the recruiting process for getting these big name guys in for combine and stuff is like, they like shiny shit.
Yeah.
You know, and agents and all that kind of stuff. Like, they want to see something new. But if all that shit was working, you know, his Olympic coaches would have figured it out already.
Yeah, like, exactly.
So it's a lot of the basics, you know, doing sprinting with good technique. Yeah, maybe a little bit of sled work here, run some hills,
yeah.
Get strong, jump, throw some medicine balls.
That's it.
And yeah.
Teach them to accelerate. Like, you spend all your time with that and you can do a lot. You can definitely do a lot.
So following with you on social media, been seeing a lot about this 20 hill challenge.
Yeah.
I know that's something that's real, real important to you. So
Tell
me how that came about and what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think we just live in a crazy time where, like, I mean, back when you were a kid, nobody was posting their workouts anywhere. You know, nobody could express themselves in that way. Like, you couldn't go onto some site and show people your workouts. Nobody cared if you worked out. If you worked out, it was on your own time, and it was like in a dark, dusty gym.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, it's become this really popular, cool, like, awesome thing where it's, which is amazing, where people are popularizing actually working out, doing ladders, doing whatever. Whatever people are doing, they're doing something, which is cool. So what I started to see was, like, number one, everything's kind of going in the trend where it's getting gimmicky. So I started running hills. And while I was running hills, I was like, you know, I'm thinking a lot just about, like, suffering while I'm running hills. And I'm thinking about how blessed and grateful I am for everything that I'm doing. And, you know, my first five hills, I would just think about everything I'm grateful for. And the next five hills, I would think about everybody I'm grateful for. And in that process, I started to kind of uncover, like, what was, like, my actual mission in getting in this field. And my actual mission was to help people. And somewhere along the way, I started to look at, like, damn, I need to make money, you know, and I want to help you, but hey, you got $10 because I got no gas and I got to choose between gas and food right now. And, you know, we've all been through it, sleeping on couches and, you know, sleeping in your car, trying to figure it out. So for me, it was like, I'm trying to balance my passion with how I make money. And I lost sight of what I really love and why I got into it. And the reason why I got into it is because sports changed my life. And it saved my life, and running saved my life. And, you know, I don't know where I'd be. You know, my mom probably knows where I'd be, but I can't tell the rest of you. And it saved my life. So I had to get back to my roots, and that's what running hills was, 20 hills. And 20 hills, the reason why I did 20 was because Jeffrey Henderson, gold medalist for long jump, USA, he told me he ran 20 hills every day growing up. And he's one of the fastest human beings on the planet. As soon as I heard that, I was like, I need to go see what this is like. And I threw up the first time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, cool. This is my thing now. So we started posting 20 Hill Challenge. And the whole goal behind 20 Hill Challenge is to end gang violence. And more so than gang violence, just like just suffering in general. Just people, like, you know, being stuck. And now it's more about mentally stuck, because you have all the tools in the world. You have iPhone, you have computer, you have internet. everything you need to be successful, to be a millionaire, to be a doctor, to be a lawyer, anything you could find online. There's no like information that's not there. So for us, it was about waking that up, not only to like the public and getting people aware that people are suffering, but also like the people that are suffering, like there's a way out. And there's a way for you to tap into what we're doing at the smallest level. Even if it's not our cool like wickets and all the sexy stuff we do, like it's something basic that anyone can do. Anyone can go find a hill and run. And I stopped posting as much about it, but we used to just pull up to random neighborhoods and I challenge kids to races and just, you know, we ran with a couple cops.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah, which is cool because like I was a bad kid growing up and I ran from cops a bunch of times. It would never like that, so that was pretty cool. So that's kind of the whole mission. I know that was long-winded, but that's...
Well, it seemed like, to me, on the outside looking in, that after, you know, when Nipsey Hussle happened, that you started posting a lot about it there.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what...
Yeah. Nipsey was, like, a huge inspiration for me. You know, coming up, 2012, 2013, like, I started jumping into this world, and I got a ticket out here from D.C., and I just stayed out here. And I was trying to figure it out on my own using the life skills that I had. And to me, Nipsey gave a blueprint. And his was different. His was gang lifestyle, which I never experienced, to becoming a millionaire. And more than a millionaire, you know, someone that owned every process that from beginning to end. So for me, it was like, I want to own my process, like how you are. Like, I looked up to you, looked up to all these people that owned their process and figured out their system and had the confidence to do that. And my whole goal was to do that, and I think I was just hesitant to do that because I cared about what people thought about me. I cared about not, you know, being smart enough or whatever it was, like all the insecurity and doubt, and I didn't want to be open. And when Nipsey died, it made me realize, like, the reason I even knew him is because he was open. And there's people that didn't like him and people that loved him, but the people that loved him because every issue that he went through is the same issue that they went through. And at any level, you look at people, you know, everyone has the same emotions, same feelings. Like, we just have different intensities of it. And seeing, you know, seeing someone be open about theirs, you start to be open about yours. And that's kind of the process that happened. And I started to be open, more open.
Awesome. Yeah. Les, where can they find you, follow you, learn more about you?
Easy. Spellman Performance, at Spellman Performance on Instagram. My Twitter is Les7Spellman. I need to get back tweeting, so tweet me, tell me, hey, you did a great job or a terrible job, just tweet me. And we're working on our website and our app that's gonna be coming out soon. You know how that goes. So right now, just hit Instagram. Yep.
All right, and if you're interested in online coaching for powerlifting, weightlifting, super total, strongman, power building, visit jtsstrength.com for all of that, as well as all of our books and that kind of good stuff. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Subscribe to the YouTube. Multiple videos a week. The best strength content on YouTube by a mile. I don't even feel cocky saying that. It's just the truth. At Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.